Well, welcome everybody, and thank you for joining our webcast today. As you know, the Association of Value-Based Cancer Care is responsible for information and dialogue in our ecosystem across all stakeholder groups. This ensures that patients will win on access and quality. We need to constantly improve and change our tactics and our deliverables in cancer care. This is why we hold these webcasts. This is why you're dialing in. We have key opinion leaders, the influencers, the important decision makers who are driving change in our ecosystem. Please join us, participate, ask questions, and offer your voice too. It's hugely important. So thank you for joining. We look forward to participating with you more. Stay safe. Thank you. So good morning. I had a chance to change into my favorite t-shirt, Lily, which is the Swim Across America, our support of 57 research laboratories for cancer, and with the hopes of putting us all out of business, right? That would be That's a wonderful gift. Yep. And so certainly, it's hard to raise money for research, as you know, but let's go back to nursing, which is what you did today. You went over, you had three of your colleagues join you, which did an unbelievable job. And, you know, look, nursing does so much. I think until somebody actually experiences cancer, unfortunately, and realizes, look, the docs are busy. They get to spend, I don't know, five. If you got 10 minutes with your physician, you're probably pretty lucky, right, at the end of the day. But from the moment you enter the system to the moment you leave, it's a nursing that provides everything to you, including making up for not making up, but so to speak, helping you understand what the doctor just said to you, which is a huge part. So I appreciate you doing that panel again today, and you're such a thought leader in the space. But what was your takeaway from this morning? What did you think that you learned? Because every time I listen to all of you, I learned something I didn't think about.
The necessity for nurses to continue to be very flexible. And I think that we're really trained to think that way and to be that way. However, oftentimes when we're changing how we do something, whether it be the setting or physically the procedure that we're doing, it's for a finite period of time. Mm-hmm. And with the pandemic, there is no finite anything, and that we need to accept the fact we're in this for the long haul, and we have to think out of the box and really go with the flow of how do we best address the needs of our cancer patients. We also very much emphasized, I think, that currently consumers are not getting cancer screenings, and that's for a very good purpose. We don't want to increase their risk of becoming part of the pandemic statistics. However, when things do eventually, probably a year from now, calm down and we can comfortably resume cancer screenings, mm-hmm. we're going to have a huge number of people. It's going to be a year to 2 years worth of patients suddenly mm-hmm. getting added to the workload of those that were already scheduled for screenings. And that big bolus of people has to go through a very tight bottleneck. And this is going to result in driving the statistics for 2021 way up for the number of people being diagnosed, whereas in 2020 we're already seeing a dramatic reduction, and it's expected to be as high as 47% less individuals diagnosed. And it isn't because people don't have cancer, it's that we're not able to look at them and biopsy them and screen them to say yes, you do have cancer. So nurses are going to be dancing even faster than they are right now to be mm-hmm. able to manage and support patients that will be in that big bolus going through that bottleneck. We also have the issue of within community outreach, underserved patients, which are difficult to lure to come in for screenings already. And how can we get creative and work with community resources in order to instill the facts, undo the myths, and also get them to come in. And for nurse navigation, a lot of our current navigation happens virtually. Whereas before we were sitting right next to the patient in the clinic, and now we're communicating via Zoom or some other media resource in order to educate and support the patients.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we heard this the other day on another panel that we had done, that we looked at what we did well, what we didn't do well. But one of the examples, we think pharma did a pretty good job, right? They kept the supplies going. They extended credit. They did a lot of things. We felt that the providers, and we heard that from your group today, you know, the practices, the hospitals, all stepped up, did amazing things, re-engineered themselves, set up foundations to help people. We know the advocacy groups did a tremendous job, but we don't think the payers did a great job during this. I mean, sure, they relaxed some of the prior auths, but they still have these nutty things out there, this copay accumulator and these copays and prior auth. You know, I always joke about it, but and you shouldn't joke about cancer, but you have to sometimes laugh at this stuff too, is who is taking, this isn't Botox, it's not a recreational drug. Who's taking a cancer drug recreationally that doesn't need, who would prescribe a drug that couldn't help anybody with horrible side effects? And so we felt that the payers quite haven't done it. And the other is we haven't done a good job of talking about screening. You know, you should come in and still get screened. I guess we were trying to deal with just to keep people in therapy, but if you kind of reflect back on it, we lost our mojo about talking about screening and prevention, because that went down by 80 and 90%. It's still way down. So what are your thoughts? What did we do right? What did we do wrong during this whole episode that we're going through?
So I think that we did do the right thing regarding delaying patients from coming in for what I'm going to call routine cancer screenings. So these would be patients that we do not consider to be at higher risk for getting cancer. Mm-hmm. They have no personal history of getting cancer. They have no current symptoms that would imply to us, ooh, this patient might have something serious going on. And we're going to continue to do that for more months to come. Where I think that it's been confusing for patients is that in the past, we'd be, you know, beating on the patient, saying, now come in annually for your mammogram and got to get in there for your colonoscopy and such. And now we're saying, well, no, it's okay if we wait. But I think we needed to say we're waiting because we don't want you to be exposed potentially to COVID-19.
Right.
So weighing the risk and benefits, but the only thing that the patient hears is, oh, you don't need to come in yet. Unfortunately, among those patients, there will be people with symptoms that we don't know about, even if we've asked them, do you have any symptoms that might warrant a diagnostic evaluation? Patients, oh, no, I'm good. And this is going to result in having a huge number of people in 2021 diagnosed, since we're already seeing in 2020 what we thought, which is that half of the patients are not diagnosed because they haven't been screened. And I think it's going to be very difficult to get some people back for screenings. For example, lung nodule screening. It's very hard to motivate someone to come in to do that today, to see if they have any early signs that we could head off at the pass that would be tied to lung cancer. But now that we've purposefully delayed them, I think it's going to be harder to get some of these people to come back in.
So Lily, to your point, should the message on screening be, you need to go for annual screening, or should, because that's a very lofty idea. I get that every 3 years, someone reminds me I need a colonoscopy screening, but isn't it maybe a better way to refine our message is these are symptoms, if you're seeing them, you need to get screened. Maybe we have to change it to more of a symptom recognition message than a, look, we did the, it was all playbook. Let's not blame anybody. This is, you know, what we're trying to do is learn from our experiences and apply them to the future. So, that would be certainly a good recommendation. So one of the other things I heard, Lily, and you might, I don't know if you read the financial pages, because you're probably always looking at the sports pages in your newspaper.
But I'm always looking at whatever's the health pages of the newspaper.
Of course you are. But let's, you know, if you went to the financial pages, you know, the healthcare companies are reporting record off-the-chart profits to their shareholders. And it's not like your auto insurance company that's nice about it and saying, well, you're not driving as much, you know, here's your rebate checks, which I've gotten too, I'm very happy. But in talking with Bruce Payson from Milliman the other day on our economic update, he predicted insurance rates next year are going up. And I think we heard from Trish Goldsmith from Cancer Care, just, you know, she's an employer too. Huge increases she's seeing for next year. Doesn't make sense to me. You know, healthcare services are down, record profits are up. And is the insurance industry doing the right thing, especially when it comes to cancer care? As you know, when you get cancer, the first thing probably most say is, am I going to become a burden on my family? Can I afford treatment? Right. So what are your thoughts going forward? You know, we're not going to see relief from insurance companies.
I think that it's not even on anybody's radar as far as patients are concerned. They're right now just looking at getting through day to day. But come November, when it's time to re-up on your, if your insurance is through your employment, to say, okay, do I want the same healthcare plan? Do I want a different one? Do I want to increase? Do I want to decrease? Commonly, unless someone already has been diagnosed with cancer, they're not reading the fine print at all. And they're just looking at how much money is going to come out of my paycheck and how can I have that be the lowest amount of money. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to see is, wow, it's not as low as it was last year. That's concerning. And what they also maybe didn't read in the fine print was how big their copays and deductibles also are going to go up. And where in the heck is that money going to come from when people have already extended their finances far beyond what they ever thought they would have to just to get through this pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, and the uninsured will get bigger. And people who are currently in therapy who have insurance might pass into an uninsured population and bring more grief. So, you know, let's keep our eyes on that as it goes forward. You know, another thing that I've heard from you and others is burnout.
Yes.
Nursing burnout. We've heard about physician burnout. But
yes.
Look, the demands are a lot higher on you. The average age of nursing today, we're an older professional occupation.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't have as many young coming in to replace the ones who are at retirement age. So what's your prediction on this? And what's the impact of a highly age-skewed average population nearing retirement, not enough backfill? And then will burnout and COVID make more people just like, you know, we've seen a lot of cops out there because of what's going on, want to just, I'm done with policing, I'm going to find a different industry. Are we seeing the same thing here?
We are. We're seeing nurses that are in their late 50s. I mean, about 50% of nurses are over the age of 55, and especially in the oncology setting. And as a result of this really gruesome, I don't have a minute to myself, experience that we've been going on for months and months, nurses are saying, I think I'm going to retire early. Or I think I'm going to go into a different type of nursing. I'm going to work for information technology and not be dealing with patients every day. Believe me, any nurse that decides to retire early or switch to a different kind of administrative nursing is going to miss patient care. There's no getting around it. That's why we chose to go into this field. We want to hold hands with patients, educate patients, support them, get our arms around them, but we're also looking at reality that we don't want to fall over dead ourselves. Mm-hmm. And people are not choosing to go into oncology nursing. So young women that are in nursing school today, they're looking for what they call the sexy nursing positions. And I thought, I didn't know any of them were sexy. But I've come to learn through the eyes of these, what I'm going to say are youngsters, that ICUs, the emergency room, are the areas that they just want to be moving fast and making decisions and life and death and such. And they consider oncology nursing to be an area of sadness. Oh, how can you work with oncology patients? You must feel sad every day. No, I don't. I actually feel really motivated. I feel thankful that I'm privileged to be able to take care of patients dealing with cancer. So I think that we need to do a better job of marketing oncology nursing. We need to have more older nurses become mentors for young nurses. Mm-hmm. We also need to probably develop more mentorships with senior nurses. Most of the time when a nurse does finish their education today and finish with their BSN, they have not had very much clinical experience in nursing school. So they have to be partnered up with a savvy nurse who's very experienced for a year before we could really turn them loose and have them be independently working inpatient unit or infusion, et cetera. That's going to be a real problem also, because we aren't going to have enough of these seasoned nurses to do this, this partnering. But I want to see people wanting to go into the field of oncology nursing and oncology nurse navigation. I want them to feel passionate as I do about it. And we know when passion and purpose come together, extraordinary things always happen.
Yeah. Well, there's IQ and EQ, the emotional quotient. And I think, you know, you have to have high EQ to be an oncology nurse to reap those rewards of helping people.
And you're right about burnout. Compassion fatigue and burnout are very real. And we do need to make sure that nurses aren't taking time for themselves, which is not the way we think. We don't think about we deserve to, you know, sit down and meditate for 20 minutes. That's not on my calendar today or this week, quite frankly, but we know if we don't take care of ourselves, we are placing ourselves at risk for compassion fatigue and burnout.
Right. So let's kind of transition as we try to finish this little segue here. Telehealth. Fabulous.
Yes.
But, you know, the only reimbursement today is if I have an MD after my name. We're not getting credit for any of the interventions that could be done pre and post the office visits by the nurses. And in fact, I come from the pharmacy side. Again, you know, play a big role. No professional support for the services involved there. So what is your industry doing to change that? Because that's obviously, we can't afford not to do this. And we have to recognize, you know, that it's got fair market value of service. So what are there any special things going on inside of the nursing segments and others? Sure.
In particular, if we look at oncology nurse navigation, this has always been a free service. We've never been able to bill in any way, shape, or form for it. And that's a challenge. I think that it sends the wrong message to healthcare administrators because they're saying, well, gee, then how many navigators do we really need if we can't bill for their time and recoup their salary and benefits? When we're looking at clinical oncology nurses not being in clinic, but instead doing telemedicine, that too is a challenge because right now that is not going to be a covered service unless it's at an advanced practitioner level where that individual is a provider. So there have been bills that have been circulated, you know, up on Capitol Hill. Things right now are, I think, in a perpetual hold because of the purposeful distraction, which needs to be, of let's work on other regulations for other purposes of getting them the care that they need, getting testing for COVID free and such. But I'm hoping in the coming months, we can revisit this. The Commission on Cancer sees oncology navigation as an essential component of cancer care. So if you don't have navigators, you're not going to meet the standards that are tied to navigation in order to be accredited as a cancer center. So that is another way that, though it's not tied to money, it is recognizing that we have value, we have purpose, and we greatly contribute to the, frankly, return on investment, certainly the patient experience, but the clinical outcome. You know, we're making sure patients don't fall through the cracks, the services and referrals that they need, we're carrying out for fertility preservation or prehabilitation and such. And we need to keep those going. We absolutely need to keep those going.
Okay. So,
but
so
we've lost the physical touch with the patient, which, believe me, really does contribute to compassion fatigue, because that was our warm fuzzy, is that we can hold our, we can get our arms around the patient, we can hold the patient. And we can't do that right now. And we haven't been able to do that for six months.
But you're coming up with some innovative ways to help relieve the fact that that's not a reality today. There's other ways. And so we struggle with that. So let's go over to AONN, Academy of Oncology Nurse Navigators. You know, there's an effort underway to record, well, set up standards, accrediting type standards. You supply CEUs and other things to be recognized for your professional training accomplishments. But one thing I think I heard about, and I'd like an update, is you're trying to measure the actual impact of these standards and what the value is. Can you give us an update on where that project stands?
Yes. Let me actually tell you about two projects related to that question. One is we have developed 35 metrics for measuring the impact that navigation has on quality patient care.
Correct.
So there are a block of measures that are related to return on investment, retaining that patient, for example, into the system, not having them drop through the cracks. Second is that patient experience. Is the patient having a better experience as a result of having continuous across the continuum navigation? And the answer is yes, and there's measures for that. And then clinical outcomes. If a patient is receiving fragmented care, and commonly they are, so the surgery got approved by their healthcare insurance to go to facility A, but their chemotherapy has to be across town at facility B, and then they're restricted as to where they could go for the radiation at facility F. Who is going to make sure that patient doesn't drop through the cracks as they're being passed from one to another? And also, who is helping to make sure that patients are adhering to oral therapies? More and more cancer therapies are in the forms of a pill. When they were all infusions, we had total control. We knew how much drug they got, when they got it, that we didn't miss any doses. Now that we're saying, well, now the patient's in control, we need to be in touch with that patient frequently in order to make sure that they are taking their medication as prescribed. We just can't say, are you taking your medication? Because they might be taking it every other day because they're having side effects. You have to say, taking your medication as prescribed. And if you aren't, it's safe to tell me. Let me know what problems you're having. Is it a financial problem for paying for the medicine? Is it the side effects that you're struggling with? So that we can fix those problems as part of our navigation process. The other is, and I'll tell you the most common thing that patients don't receive in keeping with standards of care is radiation. So they got the surgery, got their chemotherapy, their immunotherapy, but they may not have gotten their radiation, which is for many, many days, could be 6 weeks, 8 weeks. And oftentimes the bugaboo is, I can't take off from work.
Right.
So what can we do to have that patient get the 7 a.m. appointment or the 5:30 p.m. appointment, which I consider is the navigator's responsibility.
Right.
The other component of this, to answer your question, is that we're developing an acuity model. So the most common thing I'm asked is, how many oncology navigators do I need to navigate my patients at my cancer center?
Correct.
What an administrator will say. And I'll say, okay, tell me how many cancer patients, new patients you see a year. I'm not sure. Do you know what the breakdown of the types of cancer patients you're seeing? How many are breast cancer? And can you tell me by stage? How many are colorectal? How many are prostate? How many are lung? How many are brain? How many pancreatic? Nope, I don't know that. I said, you cannot manage what you do not measure.
No.
Till you know that information, and then know, do you take care primarily of underserved patients or people that are pretty wealthy? You know, those that are financially doing fine and are well-educated are going to need less navigation support than someone who has no health insurance, just became unemployed, and has advanced pancreatic cancer. So developing this acuity model is going to give us the ability to know for your facility, based on the kinds of cancer patients you take care of and what some specifics are clinically associated with their cancer, but also psychosocially associated with them as an individual person. This is what you need in each of these patient populations as far as the number of cancer patients. And what kind of cancer navigator will it be? Will it be a navigator that is navigating every and all patients that come to you? She's got to be on top of every kind of treatment for every kind of cancer. That's hard. Mm-hmm. Or do you have volume big enough in certain kinds of cancer that you can have someone specialize in breast cancer or specialize in prostate cancer? So this acuity model is going to greatly help us in being able to answer those questions. Right. And I think give better balance also to navigators. Some are, you know, putting 10 pounds of salt in the 5-pound bag. And other ones may have some room to get more patients added to them.
Well, you know, I just want to commend AONN for all the hard work you're doing. And obviously, these studies are hugely important. I also want to thank you for leading that discussion today and adding more to it. We'll be doing more in the future. Lily, you're one of the greatest thought leaders out there. I don't know how you do it and how you put in all the time you do. I know you're extremely busy, so we thank you for your time, and we look forward to seeing you on more. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. Thank you so much.
Well, gee, that was just great today, and thank you for joining. Thank you to our faculty and our panelists. As usual, great content, and the sharing of information, hugely important if we are going to improve access and the quality of care that we're responsible for delivering along with change in this ecosystem. Like today, there'll be other and future webcasts. We cover all topics and all stakeholders. Stay tuned. Also, we post this on our website. It's very important that you can dial down and share with your colleagues. So we encourage you to do that. Additionally, if any of you have any comments, send them in through our website. If anyone would like to participate in speaking or has some other ideas, please share them with us. That's our mission. Thank you for joining Talk Again.